sharing, her life she was sharing. The dark, empty void and the vast, barren earth, with anticipation, awaited the birth. Life drank from her blood, it breathed from her bones, it split her skin open and sundered her stones. The mother was giving, another was living. Her gushing birth waters filled rivers and seas and flooded the land, giving rise to the trees. From each precious drop, new grass and leaves grew, till lush, verdant plants made all the earth new. Her waters were flowing, new green was growing. In violent labor, spewing fire and strife, she struggled in pain to give birth to new life. Her dried, clotted blood turned to red, ochred soil, but the radiant child made it all worth the toil. The mother's great joy, a bright, shining boy. Ayla's breath caught in her throat when she heard those words. They seemed to tell the story of her and her son, Dirk. She remembered struggling in pain to give birth to him, and afterwards, how it was all worth it. Dirk had been her great joy. Zelandani continued in her magnificent voice. Mountains rose up, spouting flames from their crests. She nurtured her son from her mountainous breasts. He suckled so hard, the sparks flew so high, the mother's hot milk laid a path through the sky. His life had begun. She nourished her son. This story seems so familiar, Ayla thought. She shook her head as though trying to make something fall into place. Jondalar, he told me some of this on our journey here. He laughed and he played and he grew big and bright. He lit up the darkness, the mother's delight. She lavished her love. He grew bright and strong. But soon he matured, not a child for long. Her son was near grown. His mind was his own. She took from the source for the life she'd begun. Now the cold, empty void was enticing her son. The mother gave love, but the youth longed for more, for knowledge, excitement, to travel, explore. Chaos was her foe, but her son yearned to go. Ayla's mind kept nagging at her. It's not just Jondalar, she thought. I feel as if I know this, or at least the essence of it. But where could I have learned it? Then something clicked. Losaduna. I memorized all kinds of things he taught me. There was one story like this about the mother. Jondalar even recited parts of it during that ceremony. It wasn't exactly the same, and it was in their language, but Losaduna is close to Zelandani. That's why I was able to understand what they said so fast. As she listened, she concentrated on bringing the memory of the mother's story back, and began to feel a sense of the similarities and differences. He stole from her side as the great mother slept, while out of the dark, swirling void chaos crept. With tempting inducements the darkness beguiled, deceived by the whirlwind, chaos captured her child. The dark took her son, the young, brilliant one. The mother's bright child, at first overjoyed, was soon overwhelmed by the bleak, frigid void. Her unwary offspring, consumed with remorse, could not escape the mysterious force. Chaos would not free her rash progeny. But just as the dark pulled him into the cold. The mother woke up, reached out, and caught hold. To help her recover her radiant son, the mother appealed to the pale, shining one. The mother held tight and kept him in sight. Ayla began to smile as she started anticipating the next verse, or at least the essential meaning of it. The Mother Earth tells her old friend the moon the story of what happened to her son next, Ayla thought. She welcomed him back, her lover of old, with heartache and sorrow, her story she told. Her dear friend agreed to join in the fight, to rescue her child from his perilous plight. And now the listeners say it their way, Ayla said to herself. That's how the story is supposed to be told. First, the Losaduna, or the Zelandani, narrates it. Then the listeners answer, or repeat it another way. She told of her grief and the dark, swirling thief. Then it's Zelandani's turn again. The mother was tired. She had to recover. She loosened her hold to her luminous lover. While she was sleeping, he fought the cold force and for a time drove it back to the source. His spirit was strong, the encounter too long. Her fair shining friend struggled hard, gave his best. The conflict was bitter, the battle hard-pressed. His vigilance waned as he closed his great eye. Then darkness crept close, stole his light from the sky. Her pale friend was tiring, his light was expiring. When darkness was total, she woke with a cry. The tenebrous void hid the light from the sky. She joined in the conflict, was quick to defend, and drove the dark shadow away from her friend. But the pale face of night let her sun out of sight. Trapped by the whirlwind, her bright fiery sun gave no warmth to the earth. Cold chaos had won. The fertile green life was now ice and snow, and a sharp, piercing wind continued to blow. The earth was bereft. No green plants were left. The mother was weary, grieving and worn, but she reached out again for the life she had borne. She couldn't give up. She needed to strive for the glorious light of her son to survive. She continued the fight to bring back the light. And her luminous friend was prepared to contest the thief who held captive the child of her breast. Together they fought for the son she adored. Their efforts succeeded. His light was restored. His energy burned. His brilliance returned. The great Mother Earth and the moon have brought the sun back, but not all the way, Ayla was again anticipating. But the bleak, frigid dark craved his bright, glowing heat. The mother defended and would not retreat. The whirlwind pulled hard. She refused to let go. She fought to a draw with her dark, swirling foe. She held darkness at bay, but her son was away. Was the Zelandanyi version longer than the Los Adunai story? Or did it just seem that way, Ayla thought. Maybe singing the story makes it seem longer, but I really like the singing. I wish I understood it more. I think the songs change sometimes. The singing of some verses doesn't sound the same as other verses. When she fought the whirlwind and made chaos flee, the light from her sun glowed with vitality. When the mother grew tired, the bleak void held sway, and darkness returned at the end of the day. She felt warmth from her son, but neither had won. The great mother lived with a pain in her heart that she and her son were forever apart. She ached for the child that had been denied, so she quickened once more from the life force inside. She was not reconciled to the loss of her child. When she was ready, her waters of birth brought back the green life to the cold, barren earth, and the tears of her loss, abundantly spilled, made dewdrops that sparkled and rainbows that thrilled. Birth waters brought green, but her tears could be seen. I really like this next part, but I wonder how Zelandanyi will sing it, Ayla thought. With a thunderous roar, her stone split asunder, and from the great cave that opened deep under, she birthed once again from her cavernous room, and brought forth the children of earth from her womb. From the mother forlorn, more children were born. Each child was different. Some were large and some small. Some could walk and some fly. Some could swim and some crawl. But each form was perfect, each spirit complete. Each one was a model whose shape could repeat. The mother was willing. The green earth was filling. All the birds and the fish and the animals born would not leave the mother this time to mourn. Each kind would live near the place of its birth and share the expanse of the great mother earth. Close to her they would stay. They could not run away. They all were her children. They filled her with pride, but they used up the life force she carried inside. She had enough left for a last innovation, a child who'd remember who made the creation, a child who'd respect and learn to protect. first woman was born full-grown and alive, and given the gifts she would need to survive. Life was the first gift, and like Mother Earth, she woke to herself knowing life had great worth. First woman defined, the first of her kind. Next was the gift of perception, of learning, the desire to know, the gift of discerning. First woman was given the knowledge within that would help her to live and pass on to her kin. First woman would know how to learn, how to grow. Her life force near gone, the mother was spent. To pass on life spirit had been her intent. She caused all of her children to create life anew, and woman was blessed to bring forth life too. But woman was lonely. She was the only. The mother remembered her own loneliness, the love of her friend and his hovering caress. With the last spark remaining, her labor began to share life with woman. She created first man. Again she was giving. One more was living. To woman and man the mother gave birth, and then, for their home, she gave them the earth, the water, the land, and all her creation. To use them with care was their obligation. It was their home to use, but not to abuse. For the children of earth, the mother provided the gifts to survive, and then she decided to give them the gift of pleasure and caring that honors the mother with the joy of their pairing. The gifts are well earned when honors returned. The mother was pleased with the pair she created. She taught them to love and to care when they mated. She made them desire to join with each other. The gift of their pleasures came from the mother. Before she was through, her children loved too. Earth's children were blessed. The mother could rest. Ayla waited for more, but when there was only silence, she realized the mother's song had come to an end. People straggled back to their caves in twos and threes. Some would not return to their homes until the middle of the night. Some made plans to stay with friends or relatives. A few acolytes and Zelandania remained behind at the gravesite, completing some of the more esoteric aspects of the ceremony, and would not be back until morning. Several people went home with Rolona and her children and stayed overnight in her dwelling, most sleeping on the floor. It was thought necessary for many people to surround her. The Elans of deceased mates had been known to try to return to their homes before they understood that they no longer belonged to this world. The grieving mates were susceptible to invasion by the roaming spirits and needed the protection of many people to ward off malign influences. Older people in particular were sometimes tempted to follow their mates' Elans to the next world shortly after one of them died. Fortunately, Rolona was young yet and had young children who needed her. Ayla was one of those who stayed with the new widow, and Rolona seemed pleased that she did. Jandalar had planned to stay as well, but by the time he completed the last of his ceremonial duties, it was quite late, and when he looked inside the dwelling, there were so many people sprawled out he couldn't see any room to squeeze in his large frame. Ayla waved at him from the other side of the room. Wolf was with her, and probably because of him, she had a little more room around her. But when he tried to step around people to reach her, he woke a few up. Marthona, who was closer to the entrance, told him to go home. He felt a bit guilty about it, but was grateful. Overnight vigils to ward off wandering spirits were not something he enjoyed. Besides, he'd had enough dealings with the spirit world for one day, and he was tired. He missed having Ayla beside him when he crawled into his sleeping roll, but he fell asleep quickly. When she returned to the ninth cave, the one who was first went immediately into her dwelling. She would soon be making another journey to the next world, and wanted to meditate to prepare for it. She took off her chest plaque and turned it around to the plain, undecorated side. She did not want any interruptions. She would not only try to guide Chevenar's spirit to the world beyond, she planned to search for the Elan of Thonolin as well, but for that she would need both Jandalar and Ayla. Jandalar awoke with a strong urge to make some tools. Although he might not have expressed it as such, he was still feeling uneasy about all the arcane events he'd recently been involved with. Flint knapping was not only his craft, it was something he enjoyed, and getting his hands on a solid piece of stone was a good way to forget about the ambiguous, intangible, and vaguely ominous spirit world. He took out the pack of flint that he had quarried from the Lanzadanyi flint mine. Dalinar had looked over the material that Jandalar had extracted from the outcrop, which contained the superior quality flint that the Lanzadanyi were known for. He made specific suggestions regarding what pieces to take with him and helped him trim away excess material so that all he'd had to carry with him were workable blanks and cores. Horses could carry a great deal more than people, but flint was heavy. There was a limit to the amount of stone that could be taken, but when he examined the flint he had, he appreciated again just how fine it was. He selected two of the trimmed stones and put the others back, then brought out his leather bundle of flint working tools. He untied the cords and laid out several bone and antler hammers and retouchers and his hammer stones, then picked up each tool and inspected it carefully. Then he wrapped them back up along with the flint cores. By mid-morning, he was ready to find a place to work his flint, somewhat out of the way. Chips of flint were very sharp and could be quite erratic in the way they flew. Serious workers of the stone always chose to stay away from the areas where people regularly walked, especially away from the bare feet of running children and their often harried mothers or distracted caretakers. Pushing aside the entrance drape, Jandalar walked out of his mother's dwelling. Looking toward the ledge, he noticed that the sky was overcast and gray. A dreary drizzle kept almost everyone under the rock shelter, and the large open area near the dwellings was in full use. There were no particular times for pursuing individual crafts and interests, but it was the kind of day that many chose to work on their various projects. Windbreaks of panels or hide strung over cords were put up to keep out wind and any rain it might blow in, and several fires provided additional light and warmth, though cold drafts made warm clothes essential. He smiled when he saw Ayla coming toward him. When they met, he greeted her with a touching of cheeks and noticed her womanly scent. It made him remember that he hadn't slept with her the night before. He felt a sudden desire to take her back to bed and do more than sleep.
"I was just going to Marthona's to look for you," she said.
"I woke up with an urge to work the stone I got from Dalinar's flint mine to make some new tools," he said, holding up his familiar leather bundle. "But it looks like everyone wanted to work on something this morning." He glanced toward the crowded, busy workspace. "I don't think I'll stay here."
"Where will you go to work?" Ayla asked. "I thought I'd see to the horses, but I might come by later and watch."
"I think I'll go downriver. There are usually a lot of toolmakers there," he said.
Then, thinking about it, he added,
"Do you want me to help you with the horses?"
"Not unless you want to," Ayla said. "I'm just going to check on them. I don't think I'll ride today, but I may take Folara with me and see if she wants to try sitting on Winnie. I told her she could some time, and she said she'd like to."
"It might be fun to see how she does. But I really would like to work on some tools today," Jandalar said.
They walked together as far as the working area, then Jandalar went on toward downriver, while Ayla and the wolf stopped to look for Folara. The drizzle had turned to a steady rain, and while she waited for it to let up, she found herself watching first one person and then another as they worked on their various projects. She had always been fascinated with different crafts and skills and was easily distracted. It was a busy but relaxed atmosphere. Certain aspects of every craft required intense concentration, but repetitive elements allowed time to chat and visit. Most people were pleased to answer her questions, show her their techniques, and explain their methods. When Ayla saw Folara, she was in the middle of stringing a loom with Marthona and not able to come to a good stopping place easily, though she would have liked to go.
Ayla wouldn't have minded staying to see how the stringing was done, but she felt the horses needed attention. She promised Falara they would visit the horses another time, and when the rain let up, she decided to go out before it started again. Winnie and Racer were in fine fettle, and delighted to see her and Wolf when she found them, quite a distance back in Wood River Valley. They had discovered a small green meadow in the middle of the forested glen, with a clear spring that had formed a pond, and a place under some trees to stand when it rained. The red deer that were sharing it with him broke away at the sight of the woman and the wolf at the same time that the horses neighed and ran toward them. Those deer have been hunted, Ayla thought. They might have stopped and eyed Wolf, but it's not likely that full-grown deer in their prime would run from a single wolf. The wind is taking my scent right to them, and I think they have found more to fear from human hunters. The sun had come out, and she found some of the previous year's dried flower heads of teasel and used the prickly herb top to curry the horses' coats. When she was done, she noticed Wolf stalking. She reached for her sling, which was tucked into her waist thong, and a pebble from the rocky edge of the pond, and when he scared up a couple of hares, she got one of the large rabbits with her first try. She let Wolf get the other. A cloud cast a shadow over the sun. She looked up and noticed the placement of the sun in the sky, and realized that the time had passed quickly. Things had been so busy the past few days, she felt good having no demands on her or her time. But when it started to sprinkle, she decided to ride Winnie back to the ninth cave. Racer and Wolf followed. She was glad she had when the rain came down in earnest just as she arrived at the shelter. She led the horses up to the stone front porch and walked them past the living area and down toward the more unused area. She passed by some men sitting around a fire, and though she didn't recognize the game, from their actions, she guessed they were gambling. They stopped and watched her as she walked by. She thought they were very rude to stare at her the way they did, and she made a point of showing better manners by avoiding looking at them. But she did have the clan woman's skill of glancing unobtrusively, yet taking in a great deal of information with quick glimpses. She noticed that they were making comments to each other, and she thought she smelled Barma. Farther on, she saw some people in various stages of curing hides, both bison and deer. They probably found the usual work area too crowded, too, she thought. She brought the horses almost to the end of the ledge, near the small stream that separated the ninth cave from downriver, and thought that it could be a good place to build a shelter for them before winter. She'd have to talk to Jondalar about it. Then she showed them the trail that led down to the bank of the river and left them to see what they would decide to do. Wolf decided to go with the horses when they started down the trail. Raining or not, they preferred grazing near the river to staying up on the barren ledge just to keep dry. She thought about going on to see Jondalar, then changed her mind, and went back to where they were working on hides. People were glad for an excuse to take a break, and for some of them to talk to the woman that a wolf followed and from whom horses didn't run away. She noticed that Portula was there. The young woman smiled at Ayla, still trying to make friends. She seemed genuinely sorry for her part in Morona's trick. Ayla had been wanting to make some clothing for Jondalar herself and the expected baby, and remembered that she had killed a young giant deer buck. She wondered where it was. But while she was here, she decided she could at least skin the hair that was hanging from her waist thong to make something for the baby. "If there's room, I'd like to skin this hair quickly," Ayla said to the group in general. "There's plenty of room," Portula said, "and I'd be glad to let you use some of my tools if you need them." "I would, Portula. Thank you for offering. I do have many tools. I live with Jondalar, after all," Ayla said with a wry smile. Several people smiled back knowingly. "But I don't have them with me." Ayla liked the feeling of having people around her all busily engaged in tasks at which they were skilled. What a difference from the lonely days in her cave in the valley. This was more like her childhood in Brunn's clan, with everyone working together. She quickly gutted and skinned the hare, then asked, "Do you mind if I leave these here for now? I need to go downriver. I'll pick them up on my way back."
"I'll watch them," Portula said. "If you want, I'll take them back with me when I go, if you're not back yet."
"That would be very nice of you," Ayla said. She was warming to the young woman, who was obviously trying hard to be friendly.
"I'll be back later," Ayla said as she left.
After she walked up the log bridge that crossed the creek, she saw Jandalar with several others under the shelter of the first abris. The place had obviously been used to nap flint for a long time. The ground was thick with the sharp-edged chips and flakes left from the process of napping flint. It would not be wise to walk there with bare feet.
"There you are," Jandalar said. "We were just getting ready to go back. Joharan was here and said Praliva has organized a meal using meat from one of the bison. She does that so well and so often, people are going to get used to it, I'm afraid. But everybody's been busy today, and she decided it would be easier. You can walk back with us, Ayla."
"I didn't realize it was so close to midday," she said.
As they started toward the ninth cave, Ayla saw Joharan ahead of them. She hadn't seen him coming this way. He must have passed by me when I was talking to Portula and the others and skinning that hare, she thought. She noticed him heading toward the rude men who were sitting around the fire. Joharan had seen Larimar and some of the others gambling when he was hurrying to tell the craftspeople at Downriver about the meal that Praliva had arranged. He recalled thinking how lazy they were, gaming while everyone else was busy, probably using wood someone else had collected. But when he saw them on the way back, he decided he ought to tell them, too. They were members of the ninth cave, even if they didn't contribute much. The men were deep in conversation when he approached and didn't see him coming. As he drew near, he overheard one of them saying,
"What can you expect from someone who says she learned how to heal from flatheads? What can those animals know about healing?"
"That woman is no healer. Chevenar died, didn't he?" Larimar agreed.
"You weren't there, Larimar,"
Joharan interrupted, trying to keep his temper under control. "As usual, you couldn't be bothered to join the hunt."
"I was sick," the man said defensively.
"Sick from your own Barma," Joharan said.
"I'm telling you, no one could have saved Chevenar. Not Zelindani, not the most skilled healer that ever lived. He had been trampled by a bison. What man can bear the full weight of a bison? If it hadn't been for Ayla, I doubt that he would have survived until Rallona arrived. She found a way to ease his pain. Ayla did as much as anyone could."
"Why are you spreading malicious rumors about her? What has she ever done to you?"
They stopped talking when Ayla and Jandalar and several others walked past.
"Why are you sneaking around, listening to private conversations?" Larimar countered, still defensive. "Walking up to you in full daylight is hardly sneaking, Larimar. I came here to tell you that Praliva and some of the others have prepared some food for everyone, so you could share it,"
Joharan answered.
"What I heard was said out loud. I couldn't exactly close my ears."
Then he directed his comments to the others.
"Zelindani is convinced that Ayla is a good healer. Why not give her a chance? We should be glad to welcome a person with such good skills. You never know when you might need them yourselves. Now, why don't you all come and eat?"
The leader looked at each man directly, letting them know that he recognized and would remember each one. Then he walked away. The tight little group broke up and followed him toward the other end of the ledge. Some of them agreed with Joharan, at least as far as giving Ayla a chance to prove herself, but a few didn't want to, or could not, overcome their prejudice. Larimar, though he had been agreeable with the man who had been talking loudly against her, really didn't care one way or the other. He tended to go along with whatever way was easiest. As Ayla walked with the group from downriver toward the work area, staying under the protective overhanging shelf when it started raining harder again, she thought about all the different talents and abilities that people enjoyed exercising to occupy themselves. Many people liked to make things, although the choice of materials they worked with were quite varied.
Some, like Jondalar, like to work with flint to craft tools and hunting weapons. Some liked working with wood or ivory or bone. Some liked working with fibers or hides. It came to her that some, like Joharan, enjoyed working with people. As they got closer and her nose detected wonderful cooking odors, Ayla realized that cooking and working with food was also a task some people enjoyed. Proliva's penchant for organizing community gatherings was obviously something she enjoyed, which was probably the reason for this impromptu feast. Ayla thought about herself and what she liked to do best. She was interested in many things and enjoyed learning how to do things she had never done before. But more than anything else, she loved being a medicine woman, a healer. The meal was being served near the large area where people were working on their projects. But as they approached, Ayla noticed that an adjacent area was being set up for a task that may not have been quite as enjoyable, but needed to be done. Several nets for drying the meat they had hunted had been stretched out a couple of feet above the ground between upright posts. There was a layer of soil on the stone surface of the abri and its front porch, shallow in some areas, but deep enough to support posts in others. Some uprights were permanently wedged into cracks in the stone or supported by post holes dug into the soil. Piles of rocks were often added for additional bracing. Other similar constructions, obviously made for the same purpose, were simply pegged and lashed together, making them essentially portable food drying racks. They could be lifted up and leaned against the back wall to get them out of the way when not in use. But when meat or vegetables needed to be dried, the portable frames could be placed anywhere on the floor they wanted. Occasionally, meat was dried for preservation near the place it was killed, or on the grassy floodplain below. But when it rained, or just because people wanted to work closer to their homes, they developed ways to support drying cords or netting. A few small, tongue-shaped pieces of meat were already hanging on the drying racks, and small, rather smoky fires were burning nearby to keep away insects and, incidentally, to add a flavor to the meat. Ayla thought that after they ate, she would offer her help to cut up the meat to dry. She and Jondalar had just selected their food and were deciding where to eat when she saw Joharan stalking toward them with a rapid stride and a grim expression.
"Jondalar, does Joharan seem angry to you?" she asked.
The tall man turned to look at his approaching brother.
"I think so," he said. "I wonder what happened."
He would ask later, he thought. They glanced at each other, then strolled over to join Joharan, Proliva, her son Jeridol, Marthona, and Willemar. They were greeted warmly, and a place was made for them. It did seem obvious that the leader was not happy about something, but he did not seem to want to talk about it, at least not with them. They all smiled in welcome when Zelandani decided to join them, too. She had spent the morning in her dwelling, but came out when people gathered to eat.
"Can I get you something?" Proliva asked.
"I have been fasting and meditating today, preparing myself to search and still limiting my food," Zelandani said, and looked at Jondalar in a way that made him very uncomfortable. He was suddenly afraid that his association with other worlds was not over yet.
"Majera is getting something for me. I asked Falara to help her. Majera is an acolyte of Zelandani of the 14th Cave, but she is not happy with her and wants to come here with me to be my acolyte. I have to consider it, and, of course, ask if you would be willing to accept her into the 9th Cave, Joharan. She's quite shy and diffident, but definitely has some ability. I wouldn't mind training her, but, you know, I have to be particularly careful with the 14th,
Zelandani said. Then she looked at Ayla.
"She was expecting to be selected the first,"
the Danya explained,
"but the Zelandanya chose me instead. She tried to stand up to me and force me to step down. It was my first real challenge, and even though she was the one who backed down, I don't think she has ever really accepted their choice or forgiven me."
She addressed everyone again. "I know she will accuse me of luring her best acolyte away if I accept Majera,
but I have to consider what is right for everybody. If Majera isn't getting the training she should have to develop her talents, I can't worry about someone's hurt feelings. On the other hand, if one of the other Zelandanya would be willing to train her and can form a bond with her, perhaps I can avoid another confrontation with the 14th. I'd like to wait until after the summer meeting before making a decision.
That seems wise, Marthona said, just as Majera and Falara joined them.
The young acolyte was holding two bowls, and Jondalar's younger sister carried her bowl plus a water bag. She had put some eating implements in her carrying pouch. Majera gave a bowl of clear broth to the first, glanced gratefully at Falara, smiled timidly at Ayla and Jondalar, and then looked down at her food. There was a moment of uneasy silence, then Zelandani spoke. "I don't know how many of you know Majera."
"I know your mother and the man of your hearth," Willemar said. "You have some siblings, don't you?"
"Yes, a sister and a brother," Majera said.
"How old are they?"
"My sister is a little younger than me, and my brother's about his age," Majera said, indicating Proliva's son. "My name is Jeradol. I'm Jeradol of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi. Who are you?"
He said it with such careful precision as he had obviously been taught, everyone had to smile, including the young woman.
"I am Majera of the 14th cave of the Zelandanyi. I greet you, Jeradol of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi."
Jeradol smiled with self-importance. She obviously understands boys his age, Ayla thought.
"We are remiss. I think we should all make proper introductions," Willemar said.
The introductions were made, and everyone greeted the shy young woman warmly.
"Did you know the mate of your mother wanted to be a trader before he met her, Majera?" Willemar said. "He went on a few trips with me. Then he decided he didn't want to spend so much time away from her or you after you were born."
"No, I didn't know that," she said,
pleased to learn something about her mother and her mother's mate. No wonder he's a good trader, Ayla thought. He has a way with people. He can make anyone feel comfortable. Majera seemed a little more relaxed, but still a bit overwhelmed by all the attention. Ayla understood how she felt.
"Proliva, I saw some people starting to dry meat from the hunt," Ayla said. "I'm not sure how meat is divided or who is supposed to preserve it, but I'd like to help if it's appropriate."
The woman smiled.
"Of course you can help if you want. It's a lot of work. We'd welcome your help."
"I know I would," Falara said. "It can be a long, tedious job, unless there are a lot of people working on it. Then it can be fun."
"The meat itself, and half the fat, is for everyone to use as they need," Proliva continued. "But the rest of the animal, the hide, horns, antlers, and all belongs to the person who killed it. I think you and Jondalar each have a Megaseris and a bison, Ayla. Jondalar killed the bison who sacrificed Chevenar, but that one was given back to the mother. We buried it near his grave. The leaders decided to give both Jondalar and you another one. Animals are marked when they're butchered, usually with charcoal. By the way, they didn't know your Abalon and you were busy with Chevenar, so someone asked Zelandani of the third. He made a temporary one for you, so your hides and other parts could be marked."
Jondalar smiled.
"What does it look like?"
He was always conscious of his own enigmatic Abalon and curious about the name marks of others.
"I think he saw you as protective or sheltering, Ayla," Proliva said. "Here, I'll show you."
She took a stick, smoothed the dirt, and drew a line straight down. Then she added a line starting near the top and slanting down somewhat on one side, and a third line matching it on the other side.
"It reminds me of a tent or shelter of some kind, something to get under if it was raining."
"I think you're right," Jondalar said. "It's not a bad Abalon for you, Ayla. You do tend to be protective and helpful, especially if someone is sick or hurt."
"I can draw my Abalon," Jeradol said.
Everyone smiled indulgently. The stick was given to him, and he was allowed to make the drawing.
"Do you have one?" he said to Majera. I'm sure she does, Jaradol, and she will probably be happy to show you. Later,
Proliva said, gently reprimanding her son. A little attention was all right, but she didn't want him to get in the habit of demanding attention from the adults around him.
What do you think of your abalone, Ayla?
Jandalar said. He wondered about her reaction to being assigned a Zelandanyi symbol.
Since I didn't get an Elendan with an Abalon marked on it when I was born, at least not that I can remember, Ayla said, it's as good a mark as any. I don't mind using it as my Abalon.
Did you ever get any kind of mark from the Mumutoi?
Proliva asked, wondering if Ayla already had an Abalon. It was always interesting to learn how other people did things.
When I was adopted by the Mumutoi, Talut cut a mark on my arm to draw blood so he could make a mark with it on the plaque he wore on his chest during ceremonies, Ayla said.
But it wasn't a special mark,
Joharan said. It was special to me. I still have the scar, she said, showing the mark on her arm. Then she added a thought that occurred to her. It's interesting how people use different ways of showing who they are and who they belong to. When I was adopted by the clan, I was given my amulet bag with a piece of red ochre in it, and when they name a person, the Mogur makes a line in red from the forehead to the end of the nose. That's when he tells everyone, especially the mother, what the baby's totem is, by making the totem mark with salve on the infant.
Are you saying your people of the clan have marks showing who they are? Zelandani said. Like Abalons?
I guess they are like Abalons. When a boy becomes a man, the Mogur cuts the mark of his totem on him, then rubs in a special ash to make a tattoo. Girls are not usually cut on the skin, because when they grow up, they will bleed from the inside. But I was marked by the cave lion when he chose me. I have four marks from his claws on my leg. That's the clan mark for a cave lion, and that's how Mogur knew he was my totem, even though it's not usually a female totem mark. It is a man's, given to a boy who is destined to be a strong hunter. When I was accepted as the woman who hunts, Mogur made a cut here.
She put her finger on her throat, just above the breastbone, to draw blood, and used it to mark over the scars on my leg. She showed the scars on her left thigh.
Then you already have an Abalon. That's your mark, those four lines, Willemar said.
I think you are right, Ayla said. I don't feel anything about the other mark, maybe because it's just a mark of convenience, so that people will know who to give some hides to. Even though my clan totem mark is not a Zelandanyi sign, it is a mark that is special to me. It meant that I was adopted, that I belonged. I would like to use it as my Abalon.
Jandalar thought about what Ayla said about belonging. She had lost everything. She didn't know to whom she was born or who her people were. Then she had lost the people who raised her. She had referred to herself as Ayla of No People when she'd met the Mumutoi. It made him realize how important belonging was to her.
Chapter 17. There was an insistent tap on the panel beside the entrance drape. It woke Jandalar, but he lay in his sleeping roll wondering why someone wasn't answering it. Then he realized that no one but him seemed to be home. He got up and called out,
"Be there in a moment,"
while he was putting on a few clothes. He was surprised to see Jonico, the artist who was Zelandani's acolyte, only because the young man seldom paid a visit without his mentor.
"Come in."
"The Zelandani of the Ninth Cave says it is time," Jonico said.
Jandalar's brow creased. He didn't like the sound of that. He wasn't entirely sure if he understood what Jonico meant, but he had a good idea, and he wasn't looking forward to it. He'd had his share of the other world. He didn't really want to have to deal with that place again.
"Did Zelandani say what it was time for?"
Jandalar asked. Jonakal smiled at the tall man's sudden nervousness.
She said you would know.
I'm afraid I do,
Jandalar said, resigning himself to the inevitable.
Can you wait until I find something to eat, Jonakal?
Zelandani always says it's best if you don't.
I suppose you're right,
Jandalar said.
But I wouldn't mind a cup of tea to wash my mouth out with. I'm still tasting sleep. They may have some tea for you to drink,
Jonakal said.
I'll bet they do. But I don't think it's mint, and that's what I like first thing in the morning.
Zelandani's teas are often flavored with mint.
Flavored, yes, but it's probably not the main ingredient.
Jonakal just smiled.
All right,
Jandalar said with a wry grin.
I'll come right away. I hope no one minds if I go to pass water first.
It's not necessary to hold your water,
the young acolyte said,
but bring something warm to wear.
When Jandalar came back, he was both surprised and pleased to see Ayla waiting with Jonakal, tying the sleeves of a warm tunic around her waist. Jonakal had probably told her to bring something warm, too. Watching her, it occurred to him that the night before last was the first time he had not slept with Ayla since he was captured by the Sarmunai on their journey, and it left him feeling rather unsettled.
Hello, woman,
he whispered in her ear when he rubbed her cheek with his in greeting, then embraced her.
Where did you go this morning?
To empty the night basket,
Ayla said.
When I came back, I saw Jonakal, and he said Zelandani wanted us, so I went to ask Fulara if she would keep Wolf. She said she'd find some children to keep him occupied. I went down to check on the horses earlier. I heard some other horses nearby. I wonder if we should build a surround of some kind to keep them.
Perhaps,
Jandalar said,
especially when it's time for Winnie's pleasures. I'd hate to have a herd try to capture her. Racer would probably try to follow her.
She'll have her foal first, Ayla said.
Jonakal listened, interested in hearing about the horses. They had obviously gained knowledge in their association with them. Ayla and Jandalar left with Jonakal. When they reached the stone front porch of the ninth cave, Jandalar noticed that the sun was quite high.
I didn't know it was so late, he said. I wonder why someone didn't get me up sooner.
Zelandani suggested that you be allowed to sleep, since you may be up late tonight,
Jonakal said. Jandalar took a deep breath and blew it out of his mouth as he shook his head.
Where are we going, by the way?
He said as they walked beside the acolyte along the ledge toward downriver.
To Fountain Rocks, Jonakal said.
Jandalar's eyes opened wide with surprise. Fountain Rocks, a cliff that featured two caves and the immediate area around it, was not the home of any particular cave of Zelandani. It was much more important than that. It was one of the most sacred places in the entire region. Though no one lived there regularly, if any group could call it home, it was the Zelandania, the ones who served, for this was a place blessed and sanctified by the Great Earth Mother herself.
I'm going to stop for a drink of water,
Jandalar said emphatically, as they approached the bridge over the creek of fresh spring water that divided the ninth cave from downriver. He wasn't going to let Jonakal talk him out of quenching his thirst, even if he had let the man dissuade him from having his morning cup of mint tea. Near the streamlet, a few feet from the bridge, a post had been pounded into the ground. A drinking cup made of cattail leaves torn into strips and woven watertight was attached to it with a cord. If it wasn't attached, it was often lost. The cup was changed periodically as it became worn, but as long as Jandalar could remember, one had been there. It had been learned long ago that the sight of the fresh, sparkling water invariably inspired thirst, and while a person could bend over and reach in with hands to get a drink, it was much easier to have a cup handy. They all had a drink, then continued along the well-used trail. They forded the river at the crossing, and at Two Rivers Rock, turned into Grass Valley, crossed the second river, then followed the path alongside it. People from other caves waved and greeted them as they passed by, but made no attempt to delay them. All the Zelandania of the area, including the acolytes,
had already gone to Fountain Rocks, and everyone had a good idea where the two people with Zelandani's acolyte were going. They also had some idea why. In the tight-knit community, word had gotten out that they had brought back something that might help the Zelandanya to find the wandering spirit of Jondalar's dead brother, Thanalan. Though they knew it was important to help guide a newly liberated Elan to its proper place in the world of the spirits, the idea of entering the next world before they were called by the mother was not something most people wanted to do. It was fearful enough to think about helping Chevenar's Elan, who had just passed on and was probably nearby. But to look for the spirit of someone who had died far away and a long time ago was something they didn't even want to contemplate. Not many, except for the Zelandanya, and not all of those, would have wanted to trade places with Jondalar or Ayla. Most people were happy to let the ones who served the mother deal with the world of the spirits. But no one else could do it. Only they knew where Jondalar's brother had died. Even the one who was first knew this would be an exhausting day, though she was intrigued and wondered if they would be able to find Thanalan's roving spirit. As Ayla, Jondalar, and Jonakul continued upstream, an imposing outcrop of rock loomed ahead on the left. Approaching it, the massive rock stood out with such prominence it seemed almost a monolith, but a closer look revealed that it was only the first spur of a progression of cliffs that pulled back in a line at right angles to Grass River. The stately stone at the head of the cliffs reared up from the valley floor, rounded to a bulge in the middle, narrowed toward the top, then abruptly flared out into a flat-topped, jaunty cap. Moving around to the front and looking straight on at the rock that extended out ahead, one could, with a little imagination, envision in the cracks and rounded shapes the cap as hair, a high forehead below the cap, a flattened nose, and two nearly closed eyes enigmatically looking over a slope of scree and brush. To those who knew how to look, the subtly anthropomorphic front view was understood to be a hidden face of the mother, one of the few visages of herself she ever chose to show, and even that was well disguised. No one could ever look directly upon the face of the mother, not so much as a likeness of it, and even mysteriously disguised, her face held unspeakable power. The row of cliffs flanked a smaller valley with a creek down the middle that ran into Grass River. The source of the small stream was a spring that bubbled out of the ground with such energy it created a small fountain with a deep pool surrounding it in the middle of a wooded glen. The common name was Fountain of the Deep, and the small waterway running from it was called Fountain Creek, but the Zelandanya had other names for them, which most people also knew. The spring and pool were the birth waters of the mother, and the creek was the blessed water. They were known to have great powers to heal, and particularly to help women conceive, if used correctly. A path over 1,200 feet long climbed up the side of the stone wall, well beyond the leading spur, to a terrace not far from the top, with a small rock overhang that sheltered the mouths of two caves. The numerous cavities in this region of limestone cliffs were sometimes called caves, but were thought of as hollowed-out spaces in the rock, and often referred to as hollows as well. Conversely, an especially long or deep cave was sometimes referred to as a deep. The opening to the left on the small terrace penetrated the rock only 20 feet or so, and was used as a living space for those who stayed there from time to time, usually Zelandanya. It was generally known as Fountain Hollow, but some referred to it as Dani's Hollow. The cave on the right led to a deep passage that went 400 feet into the heart of the huge cliff, with chambers, alcoves, niches, and other passages leading off the main corridor. This was the place that was so sacred that its esoteric name was not usually even voiced. The site was so well known and so revered, it wasn't necessary to declare its sanctity and power to the mundane world. If anything, those who knew its true meaning preferred to understate it, not to make an issue of it in ordinary existence. That was the reason people referred to the cliffs simply as Fountain Rocks, and why the cave was called the Deep Cave in Fountain Rocks, or sometimes Donnie's Deep. It was not the only sacred site in the region. Most caves had some measure of sanctity attached to them, and some places outside of caves were also blessed. But the Deep Cave in Fountain Rocks was one of the most exalted. Jondalar knew of a few others that equaled Fountain Rocks, but none was more important. As they continued up the cliff with Jonakul, Jondalar felt a combination of excitement and dread and, as they approached the terrace, a frisson of fearful anticipation. This wasn't something he really wanted to do, but for all his apprehension, he did wonder if Zelandani could find the free spirit of his brother, what would be expected of him, and how it would feel. When they reached the high terrace in front of the caves, two more acolytes met them, a man and a woman. They had been waiting just inside the mouth of the deep cave on the right. Ayla paused for a moment and turned around to see where she had come from. The lofty stone porch overlooked Fountain Creek Valley and part of Grass Valley with its river, and the panorama was impressive. But somehow, when they entered the passage, the closer views within the dark cavity were more daunting. Especially in daytime, stepping into the cave brought an immediate transformation, a shift in perspective from an open, expansive view to a close, narrow corridor, from stone-reflecting sunlight to disquieting dark. The change went beyond the physical or external. Especially to those who understood and accepted the inherent power of the place, it was a metamorphosis that went from easy familiarity to apprehensive fear, but also a transition into something rich and wondrous. Only a few feet of the ingress could be seen from the light outside, but as eyes became accustomed to the diminished light at the entry, the rock walls of the constricted passage suggested the way into the shadowy interior. A small vestibule just beyond the opening held a lighted stone lamp resting on a projecting piece of the wall and several unlit lamps. In a natural stone niche below it were torches. Jonakul and the other young man picked up a lamp, then a thin, dry stick, which they held to the flame of the burning lamp until it ignited. With it, they each lit the moss wicks that were resting against the edge of the bowl of a lamp, opposite the handle, soaking in the slightly congealed fat. The woman lit a torch and beckoned to them.
"Watch your footing," she said, holding the torch lower to show the uneven floor and the wet, glistening clay that filled in some of the spaces between the rocks that were jutting up. "It can be slippery."
When they started into the passage, picking their way carefully across the uneven floor, there was still a suggestion of light from the outside. It diminished quickly. After something more than 100 feet, the darkness was complete, held back only by the soft glow of small flames. A sigh of moving air strayed down from the stalactites suspended from the ceiling, bringing a chill of fear as the tiny lights of the lamps flickered. They knew that once into the depths, if the fire went out, a blackness more complete than the darkest night would obscure all vision. Only hands and feet on cold, damp rock could show the way, and might lead only to a dead-end passage rather than the way out. A deeper black on the right, no longer reflecting the small flames off damp stone walls, indicated that the distance to that side had increased, perhaps a niche or another passageway. Behind them and ahead, the tenebrous gloom was palpable, the blackness almost suffocatingly thick. The wisp of air was the only manifestation of a corridor that led back to the outside. Ayla wished she could reach for Jondalar's hand. As they proceeded, the lamps the acolytes carried were not the only light. Several shallow, bowl-shaped stone lamps had been placed on the floor at intervals along the dark corridor, casting a light that seemed amazingly bright in the darkness within the cave. A couple of them were sputtering, however. They either needed more fat to melt into the bowl or a new moss wick, and Ayla hoped someone would tend to them soon. But the lamps gave Ayla an eerie sense that she had been in this place before, and an irrational fear that she would be again. She didn't want to follow the woman in front of her. She had not thought of herself as one who feared caves,
but there was something about this one that made her want to turn around and run or touch Jandalar for reassurance. Then she remembered walking the dark corridor of another cave, following the small fires of lamps and torches, and finding herself watching Kreb and the other Mogurs. She shivered at the memory and suddenly realized that she was cold.
"You might want to stop and put on your warm clothing," the woman in front said, turning back and holding up the lamp for Ayla and Jandalar. "It's rather cold deep in a cave, especially in summer. In winter, when it's snowy and icy outside, it actually feels rather warm. The deep caves stay the same all year."
The stop for something as ordinary as putting on her long-sleeved tunic had steadied Ayla. Although she had been ready to turn around and run out of the cave, when the acolyte started walking again, Ayla took a deep breath and followed her. Although the long passageway had seemed narrow and the temperature had become progressively colder, after another 50 feet, the rocky corridor closed in even more. A greater humidity in the air was verified by a sheen of moisture reflected off the walls, the stalactite icicles projecting down from the ceiling, and their stalagmitic mates growing up from the floor. At slightly more than 200 feet into the dark, damp, and chilly cave, the floor of the passageway ascended, not blocking the way, but making it difficult to proceed. It was tempting to turn back here, to think this was far enough, and many a faint heart had. It tested determination to continue beyond this point. Holding the torch, the woman in front climbed up the rocky incline to a small, constricted opening higher up. Ayla watched the wavering light as she climbed, then breathed deeply and started up over sharp stones until she reached the woman. She followed her through a narrow aperture, scrambling over more rocks to get through the opening that descended into the heart of the stone cliff. The nearly subliminal passage of air in the first section was noticeable now only for its lack. After the confined gap, no movement of air could be detected at all. The first indication that someone had come this way before was 3 red dots painted on the left-hand wall. Not long afterward, Ayla saw something else in the flickering light of the torch the woman in front held. She couldn't quite believe her eyes and wished the acolyte would stop for a moment and hold the light closer to the left wall. She stopped and waited for the tall man behind her to catch up.
"Jandalar," she said in a quiet voice, "I think there is a mammoth on that wall."
"Yes, there is, more than one," Jandalar said. "I think if there wasn't something that Zelandani felt was more important to do right now, this cave would be shown to you with the proper ceremony. Most of us were brought in here when we were children. Not young children, old enough to understand, but still children. It's frightening but wonderful when you see this place for the first time, if it's done right. Even when you know it's all part of the ceremony, it's exciting."
"Why are we here, Jandalar?"
she asked.
"What is so important?"
The acolyte in front had turned around and come back when she noticed she wasn't being followed anymore.
"Didn't anyone tell you?" she said. "Jonakol just said that Zelandani wanted Jandalar and me," she said.
"I'm not absolutely certain," Jandalar said, "but I think we're here to help Zelandani locate Thonolin's spirit, and if he needs it, to help him find his way. We're the only ones who saw the place where he died, and with the stone you wanted me to pick up, Zelandani said that was a very good idea, by the way. She thinks we may," Jandalar said.
"What is this place?"
"It has many names," the woman said. Jonakol and the other acolyte had caught up with him. "Most people refer to it as the Deep Cave in Fountain Rocks, or sometimes Dani's Deep. The Zelandanya know its sacred name, and most people do too, though it's seldom mentioned. This is the entrance to the womb of the mother, or one of them. There are several others that are just as sacred."
"Everyone knows, of course, that entrance implies exit," Jonakol added. "That means the entrance to the womb is also the birth canal."
"So that means this is one of the birth canals of the Great Earth Mother," the young male acolyte said.
Like the song Zelandani sang at Shevenar's burial. This must be one of the places from which the mother brought forth the children of the earth,
Ayla said.
She understands, the woman said, nodding toward the other two acolytes. You must know the mother's song well, she said to Ayla.
The first time she heard it was at the burial,
Jandalar said, smiling. That's not entirely true, Jandalar, Ayla said. Don't you remember? The Los Adunai have something like it, except they don't sing it, they just say the words. The Los Adunai taught it to me in their language. It's not exactly the same, but it's similar.
Maybe that's because Los Adunai can't sing like Zelandani,
Jandalar said.
Not all of us sing it, Jonakal said. Many just say the words, I don't sing, and if you ever heard me, you'd know why.
Some of the other caves have different music, and some of the words are not exactly the same either, the young male acolyte said. I'd be interested in hearing the Los Adunai version sometime, especially if you can translate it for me, Ayla.
I'd be glad to. Their language is very close to Zelandani. You might be able to understand it even without a translation, Ayla said.
For some reason, all three acolytes suddenly noticed her unfamiliar accent. The older woman had always thought of the Zelandani, the language and those who used it, as special. They were the people. They were Earth's children. It was hard to grasp the idea that this woman could think that people who lived all the way across the plateau glacier on the highland to the east could have a language that seemed similar to their own. The foreign woman must have heard many languages of people who lived far away that were very much different from Zelandani to think so. It struck them all how different the language of this foreign woman was from theirs, and how much she knew about other people that they didn't. Jandalar, too, had learned much on his journey. In the few days since he had been back, he had already shown them many things. Perhaps that was the reason for journeys, to learn new things. Everyone knew about journeys. Almost all young people talked about making one, but few actually did. And even fewer of those went very far, at least not that came back. But Jandalar was gone 5 years. He had traveled far, had many adventures, but more important, he brought back knowledge that could benefit his people. He also brought ideas that could change things, and change wasn't always so desirable.
I don't know if I should show you the painted walls as we pass by. It might spoil the special ceremony for you, but you are bound to see at least part of them, so I suppose I could hold up the light and let you see them a little better, the woman in front said.
I would like to see them, Ayla said.
The acolyte in front held the torch up high so the woman Jandalar had brought home with him could see the paintings on the walls. The first one, the mammoth, was painted showing a side view, the way most portrayals of animals that she had seen were made. The hump on the head followed by a second hump high on the withers, but slightly lower down the sloping back, made it easy to recognize. That configuration was the distinctive feature of the great woolly beast, even more than its curving tusks and long trunk. It was painted in red, but shaded in reddish-brown and black to show the contours and precise anatomical detail. It was facing the entrance and was so perfectly made that Ayla half expected the mammoth to walk out of the cave. Ayla didn't quite understand why the painted animals looked so lifelike or fully appreciate what it had required, but she couldn't resist looking closer to see how it was done. It was an elegant and accomplished technique. A flint tool had been used to cut a fine, distinct outline of the animal with exacting detail into the limestone wall of the cave.